Don't Mess Around with Jim, Time in a Bottle, Bad Bad Leroy Brown, Operator. I can go on. There are so many timeless hits from the late, great Jim Croce, who was taken too soon, way back in 1973 when he was killed in a plane crash. I recently had the chance of spending some time with his old friend Mike DiBenedetto, and we talked for almost an hour about Jim's life and, of course, his music. Check it out. Hope you like it.
So I guess just taking me back to the beginning when you first met Jim.
Jim and I met in September of 1961. We're standing in line outside the old field house waiting to register for courses.
Where's this?
Villanova, I'm sorry.
No.
I forgot to mention. Yeah, Villanova at the old field house. And we just started talking. And one thing led to another. And the more we talked, the more we realized how much in common we had. And so we struck up a friendship. Went in and registered. Next thing you know, we had classes together, including one of the classes we had together was Intermediate German. And Jimmy had a real knack for that, for the language. He really was very good at it. I was very impressed by that. And a few other classes together. It wasn't, and then we started hanging out together. I would go to his house, he'd come to mine, but I think I spent more time at his house than he did at mine. My mom used to get a little bit upset. But as time went on, we really became closer and closer. In our sophomore year, this is when he had been bugged by Tommy, that's Tommy Picardo, Tommy West, to join the Spires because they not only had that, but they had the Coventry lads, and Jimmy was interested in that, so he joined that. I wasn't interested. Tommy was a little disappointed about that, but anyway.
Now, the Spires were just pretty much folk?
No, the Spires were, that was a glee club.
Oh, okay.
Villanova, a male glee club. The Coventry Lads was primarily folk, like New Christy Minstrels and the Serendipity Singers. This is, you know, early 60s. Folk was monstrous then. And then Jim and I auditioned for the radio station, and Tommy was the one who auditioned us because he was music director on the radio station there at Villanova. And we each had our own separate shows, but on Sunday nights we did a four-hour folk show. We did that for a couple of years. In my senior year, I became program director. And we still continue doing that. But while we were doing the radio show and while we were at Villanova, we also did, we did concerts at Villanova. Tommy and Tim Hauser, the founder of the Manhattan Transfer, were on campus at the time. And they were like producers, sort of like, and they put together these shows every year, like a talent show type of thing. And Jimmy would perform and I performed. And then we also did things together and separately in all the folk houses in those times. We did, and we, you know, the parties and so forth like that. So we really formed a great bond. We traveled around a lot together. I went to gigs with him. He had this one time, he had a gig up in Reading. And by this, I'm just going all over the place now. When we went to Reading, he was already dating Ingrid. And I was dating Ingrid's sister. How convenient, right? So we went up to Reading and he did a concert up there and I was with him. Very nice. And then we drove back. And when we were at this place in Reading, it was up on a mountain at a gift shop. And he bought something for Ingrid. I bought something for Phyllis, Ingrid's sister. And we brought him back and gave it to him. And we used to go over to Ingrid's house at least once a week, once every other week, and go down to the family room. I'd bring my guitar. He'd bring his. I have a classical guitar, Gibson Classical from 1961. And we'd just play and sing for hours, back and forth. Sometimes you do everything in unison. Sometimes you do it in harmony. Sharing songs and so forth. This is the way that we just killed time and just loved being together. And there were many times that Jim and I were together where we didn't talk. We were just being, you know, we just enjoyed being with each other. Jimmy was 11 months older than me, so he was like an older brother to a degree. Then there were other times, one of the strange things we had was we knew each other's likes of music. So if we'd hear a song, we'd say, oh, boy, that'd be great for Jim. Or Jim would hear us, oh, wow. Or Richie would say, that's a great song for Mike, you know. And we'd tell each other about songs. And then sometimes we would just get together, Jim and I, with our guitars, and we would just sing for each other. I would sing a song for Jimmy, then he'd sing a song for me. We'd kill hours like that. It was a strange relationship. It really was. But it was beautiful, you know. And that formed a bond even deeper. We both graduated in 65. Now, Tommy and Tim were 2 years ahead of us. And they eventually they live in Asbury Park, or lived in Asbury Park, North Jersey. And again, they were like producers. They got together this concert with Joshua Jr., who was a big folk music man at that time. And they had him at Asbury Park Theater, which is at the end of their boardwalk. And at Asbury Park, their Coliseum, whatever you want to call it, arena. And they had Jimmy to be his opening act. So again, Jimmy and I go up to North Jersey. We stayed overnight at Tommy's mom's house. She was wonderful. Treated us like we were her kids.
Now, was Jim doing covers at the time? Was he still writing?
No, he hadn't started writing yet. Jimmy hadn't really gotten into writing yet. No, he was doing covers. And he went on stage. He did about 45 minutes and opened up for Josh White, who was received very nicely. And then Josh White went on and did his thing, and then that was that. So all the while, I think in the back of Tommy's mind, he was wondering what he could... He really thought the world of Jim as a person and as a performer. And so he was thinking, gee, what can we do to help him out? Because this, you know, he's got a lot of talent. He really did. And time moved on. So we stayed together pretty much. I was with him when he met his wife. We were doing a radiothon at the old convention center. And she was in a four-piece folk group, singing group. And he was doing something. I don't know whether I did anything that day or not. I don't remember. But I know Jimmy did. Joe Niagara from the radio station WIBG at the time. He was one of the hosts for it. So Jim met Ingrid that night. And actually, the group that she was with, this two male, two female folk group, he began to coach, right? And one thing led to another, and you know, pretty soon they began their relationship. Let's see. And, oh, this is neat. In the semester break of our senior year, Jim was very impetuous, very off the cuff. He said, Mike, let's take a trip down south where it's warm. I said, okay, Jim, when are we leaving? He said, tomorrow, pack. I said, okay. So I packed a little clothes, took my guitar, naturally. He came by, picked me up in his Volkswagen, and we drove down 95, just heading south. As we're on 95, he's in this Beetle. Now, they're not too heavy. Tractor trailer trucks are blowing by us. Now, the top speed in this Volkswagen that he had was, I think, 65. I think that was it. Foot to the floor, pedal to the metals type of thing. And these trucks are blowing by us. And every time we went by, we shifted a lane. And he starts cussing. He says, and that's so beast. They think that 95 is the damn speed limit. They don't know it's a root lumber sign. Well, later on, that concept ended up in one of his songs, Speedball Tucker. And that's one of the things that the cops said, you know, 95 is the route you were on, not the speed limit sign. This is one of the things also with Jimmy. He would come up with these nuggets and they would just stay in the back of his head. And later on, they would end up in songs. Mm-hmm. So we get down south and we stopped at a number of places. One of the places we stopped in was Virginia, because he said, why don't we stop in Virginia? We'll get a Virginia ham and we'll get it cut in half. We'll give half to your mom and half to my mom. That's a great idea. So we go into this place. I don't know how he found it. We went to this place, and we're standing there waiting to talk to the guy. We hear, pow, pow, gunshots. We say, holy shit, do we have to get that? What's going on, right? It turns out they're shooting the pigs back in the, you know, behind wherever, in their warehouse. They're shooting the pigs, and then that's, oh, I said, oh, my God. Another thing he wanted to do was he said, I want to buy a genuine pair of Levi's. I said, can't you buy them, you know, where we live? He said, no, I want to get them from you. So we went to this dry goods store someplace down south. It might have been in North Carolina. I'm not sure. And he got his jeans. Yeah, big deal. We end up in this place called Kill Devil Hills, which is actually where the Wright brothers threw their plane. In fact, there's a museum there, right? So we pull in and we stop at this motel. And this is one of those really big towns. It had a general store with a gas station, a motel, and the Sportsman Restaurant Bar. That was it. And a lot of sand. So we got our room and so forth, our rooms. And he says, let's go, you know, to the restaurant, get something to eat. He says, I'm dying for some genuine Southern fried chicken. I said, sounds good. So we go in and we're sitting in the booth and we're saliving now because we're going to get some genuine fried chicken. Well, we could see the kitchen. And we see the cook go into the freezer and bring out a prepackaged chicken. Must have been, you know, from some particular country, company or whatever that did this stuff. And we both said, ah, because we were thinking they were going to be in that back there battered. Well, right. It was pretty good, but it's sort of disappointing. Then we came home. We stayed in touch, you know, throughout the time after we graduated and so forth. In fact, I was one of the first people that he told that Ingrid and he were going to get married. And I was a little bit upset because I was losing my best friend, you know. But I was happy for him. And it was a good thing. Jim still, he worked for a radio station for a while, selling airtime, like I said before, he was teaching. He tried different things to earn money. All the while, he's working these small places, etc. And doing okay. Has a nice following. We made the album in Facets in this, I think it was like, when the heck was it? Sometime in 66. Might have been the spring of 66 or something like that. And he was selling, he only had 3,000 copies made of Facets. And he sold them for $5 a piece. And
okay, well, I'm holding the album in my hand. The actual album.
The original.
The original album in my hand. What are the origins of this? Where was this recorded? Where did you guys go?
We did it on a Saturday, and we went down to Wilmington. There was a studio that he found, or a recording studio that he found, that specialized in acoustic music. And everything we did was acoustic, except for the accordion that I used on Sun Come Up. I put that through an amplifier. That didn't present much of a problem. Everything else was acoustic. So we went down there on a Saturday, and we did the whole album in one day. He went back a few weeks later to do the mix, and then he began to sell it. And he sold it for like $5 a copy.
And I'm looking at it, and it's...
Spartan.
It's very, very empty, but all the liner notes are actually... He typed it up or someone typed
Sal
it up?
Joe Salviola, who also went by the stage name Sal Joseph.
Okay, just typed up some notes and made copies and stuck it in here.
And so, in fact, Sal Joseph is the one who wrote the song Thursday on Jimmy's third album.
Okay.
Yeah. We knew Sal from when he was at Villanova. He was a brilliant, the man was a genius. And he was really an expert in folk music. You ask him anything. In fact, that's what he taught Rowan, what used to be Glassboro College, Glassboro State University. That's where he met Maury. And later Rowan introduced Maury to Tom and Terry. And they produced his first album.
Now, when he did Facets, these are pretty much original songs.
No, there's only two originals.
Two original songs?
Yeah. Texas Rodeo and Sun Come Up are the only two originals. I think that...
When did you first realize that he had... That knack for writing, was he always dabbling, or?
The first inkling that I got that he was writing, we were both, I guess, dabbling and messing around with it. But the first song that he got serious about, as far as I know, was Sun Come Up. And he and Richie must have, you know, collaborated on it to a degree. He called me one day and said, come on over, Mike. He says, I wanted to share something with you. So we go, and they had this patio out behind our house. And I remember the weather was nice, we're sitting on this rock or whatever. And he sings Sun Come Up. And I loved it. And he said, what do you think? I said, it's great. You know, I enjoyed it, you know. And I had, you know, he was wanting me to give some critique, some ways that maybe he could change or improve it. And I could come up with nothing. Everything was fine as far as I was concerned. Then he tells me that he'd like to someday, you know, record that. He didn't sing Texas Rodeo for me. I don't know whether it had been written yet or not. Mm-hmm. But that, as far as I know, was the first one that he really wrote beginning to end and finished it. And really thought about doing something with it. So it was a few months later that we ended up going into the studio and doing that. And all the guys in the studio that were with him were all friends, you know, that he knew from college. And like I told you earlier, Carl Fernbach, who played banjo, phenomenal. Oh, God. If you know who Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs are, Earl Scruggs, he could give Earl Scruggs a run for his money. Let me tell you, this kid was good. Really good. So, yeah. And then after we did that, he got married. They lived in Media for a while. And when I got married, we used to go to each other's places. My wife and I went to Media, and this is how she met. She heard me talking about Jimmy, you know, but she had never met him. So we went to Media, and then we introduced, and they hit it off beautifully, you know, Ingrid and my wife Joanne. And they came to our apartment. My wife liked it, but she didn't like it because she knew damn right well that he was going to bring a guitar, and I was going to take my guitar out. And next thing you know, we'd be singing and playing. She'd be in the chair, sound asleep, and we'd be up till like 3 o'clock in the morning just doing what we always did. And she just couldn't get over that, that, you know, we just could sing and sing and sing and sing and share songs and so forth. And this is when, whatever we got together, this is what we did. This is how we enjoyed each other. In Jimmy's house in Media, two things I remember about the place, he had a harmonium. A harmonium. Who the hell has a harmonium? It was used on one of the Beatles songs. It was like a, you have these foot pedals that you would push to put air through the keyboard, and it was like a keyboard, like a piano, but it had a real distinct sound. And he had a true steel guitar. The whole damn thing was steel except for the fretboard, which was like rosewood or something. Everything else, steel. It was wicked. It had a weird sound too because of the reverberation through steel. I had never seen one, but he had one. Leave it to Jimmy. Yeah, we had some good times, some good times. Eventually, he had written a number of songs, and him and his wife started singing together a lot because she had a beautiful voice. So he had contacted Tommy, etc., and they went to New York. Mm-hmm. And Tommy said, "Okay, I like the songs," and they were right in line with what had been going on in the music business or whatever. But Tommy felt reluctant to produce it yet, even though he had a production company. Him and Terry Cashman had formed it, called Interrobang. So he contacted his friend at Capitol. They produced it, you know, got the musicians and so forth. Did a nice job. Finished the album. Was good, etc. But then the executives from Capitol decided it wasn't strong enough to release. So they just put it in the vault, so to speak. Tommy was upset about that. He really was. Then he tried to find other things for Jimmy to make money. In fact, he wanted Jimmy to start maybe working, writing commercials for the company that he had, because that's how Tommy made a lot of money, was writing TV and radio commercials.
Making jingles.
Yeah, jingles. It was a, you know, booming business. Mm-hmm. So he says he wanted to write jingles. He said, "Oh, yeah, all right." He didn't want Jimmy singing them because he didn't want to taint that yet. But right. He said, "You know, how about writing some jingles?" Yada, yada. Okay. So he gave Jimmy a $10,000 advance. Jimmy didn't put one word to paper. But so after about a year of just struggling in New York, they said, "To hell with this," and they went and left and went to Lindell, Pennsylvania. This is about the time that he started driving truck. And when Ingrid became pregnant and knew that the baby was on the way, Jimmy said, "Holy cow, I have got to get serious. We got to do something. You know, I got a family now that I got to worry about." And this is when he sat down and began to write seriously. Now, before this happened, he had spent time with Maury. Maury had put his album out, Gingerbread, and Jim had been his accompanist. And he saw the talent that Maury had and the chord structures and the melody structures that Maury had used in his songs, and was influenced by that, which just expanded Jim's musical horizon to no end. So he went to Lindell, he wrote four songs, put them on a cassette, and sent them to Tommy. One of them was Operator, another one was Time in a Bottle. I don't even know the other two. Tommy went ballistic. He called him up right away and says, "Now you're writing from the heart. Now you're writing from your own experience. You're not making things up. This is you." He says, "Do me some more." And he started contacting other companies and producers and so forth. Finally, they got together. It was around the time of Richie's wedding. In fact, Jimmy had asked me to, at Richie's wedding, we were all in it, in Richie's wedding party.
This is his brother.
His brother Richie, I'm sorry. Yeah, his brother Richie. Another nice guy, nice kid. He's about, I think, 2 years younger than Jimmy or something like that. And at that banquet, wedding banquet, that's when Jimmy said, "You know, I'm going to be recording this album of originals." He says, "I'd love you to play piano." I said, "Jim, I can't. You know, I got a full-time gig. I'm teaching, etc. I can't leave for a couple of weeks to go to New York." He was very disappointed, but he understood. Anyway, the following summer, I think it was like the middle of the summer, the album comes out. Which was You Don't Mess Around with Jim, title cut, title of the album. If it wasn't for the fact that he had his producer Tommy and his manager, Elliot Abbott, they tried to go to a different number of different record companies. They weren't interested, including ABC Dunhill. Well, Elliot Abbott was playing tennis with one of the executives from ABC Dunhill, and he was laying on the guy, "Hey, you know, I got this talented kid and so forth, and we sent you this, etc., etc., and you didn't nothing." He said, "I know nothing about it." He said, "You got the CD or you got the cassette?" He says, "Yeah, let me listen." This executive listens, says, "I'll sign him up." With that, it was like the 12th or 13th group that they had gone to. They said, okay, and they put it out. And that album came out. Matty Singer in Philadelphia became the promoter. And I remember the first time I heard the song, I'm driving down the road, Route 42, and he was at the Steel Pier when they used to do shows from the Steel Pier. And I hear the guy announce, well, here's a new song from a local boy, yada yada, Jim Croce, you don't mess around with Jim. I nearly went off the road and smashed into a tree. I couldn't believe it. And what happened was, Matty Singer that day was calling every radio station saying, I got Jim Croce in the car, why don't you play his record so we can hear it? And he would just keep switching stations so Jimmy could hear his song on all these different radio stations. Matty was a hoot. I met him a few years later when I did a concert at Upper Darby High School to induct Jimmy into the Decca Hall of Fame there. He was the first inductee, by the way. So anyway, that was the first album. Yeah, a lot of good stuff. A lot of good stuff.
Now, how did his music style grow? Obviously, he was with Murray. What was Murray's background? Was he more folk? Was he rock or
Murray was?
He's so prevalent in his leads and stuff as he accompanies Jim.
Here's a lot of people don't know. Murray was an accomplished classical pianist. That's where he learned his music. And what he did was he transferred his classical knowledge to the guitar. Tommy told me when I saw him, he said Murray was the only musician he'd ever known that could overdub his solos and play them exactly the same way, note for note, with the same intonations and the same feel. This is why when you hear the solos that Murray does or the fills that Murray does on Jimmy's records, they sound so big because they are overdubbed two or three times. And Murray did them exactly the same way every time.
Okay, because I guess one thing that stands out, and I'm sure everyone else is more familiar with it, is Operator.
Yes.
As it comes in, all the little intricacies.
The fills, yeah.
That's just Murray's trademark.
Yeah. Well, this is what Jimmy learned from him. There's other things that Jimmy picked up from other people. there's a way that he plays some of the bar chords when he's doing like Leroy Brown, a few others. If you watch him, he'll go back and forth and he'll open up and so forth.
Right.
I'll take credit for that.
Really?
Yeah, because years ago.
Because I've noticed him do that, because I tried to do it that way, and it's like on an off beat or
exactly.
Something. You know, where normally I would get my pinky to do
the moving fifth, yeah.
And
no, he does it different.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the reason is because that goes back to blues and jazz.
Okay.
And that's where I learned it from. And he saw me doing that one day with some of the blues or jazz songs that I used to do. It could even be used in rock and roll. And he liked it, and he started imitating it also. So at certain songs, it works. Others, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. So when it felt right, he would use it. And I felt glad, you know, gee, it worked, you know, because it doesn't always. AJ just put out another album. And on this album, his latest one.
AJ Croce.
I'm sorry, his son, AJ Croce, yeah. On the latest album, there is a song on there from Jim Croce that has never been done before. Ingrid got her hands on it from one of the master tapes that they had done. And all it was, I think, was originally was just Jimmy and his guitar doing this song that he eventually was going to, you know, maybe go into the studio and so forth. He did it in the studio, but it wasn't a finished song. And Ingrid got her hands on it. AJ now recorded it, put it on his latest album. And guess who's playing with AJ? Vince Gill, who does the lead guitar solos on acoustic. And Steve Cropper from the Blues Band is playing electric guitar on it. So he's got some good people. He did it in Nashville. It's a great song called Name of the Game. And it's typical Croce. As soon as you hear the intro, the way it works is, oh, that's Croce. Sounds like Don't Mess Around with Jim and Leroy Brown and so forth, like that type of thing. You know. So, yeah.
How long did you stay in contact with Jim? At what point did you realize that he was just taking off?
Oh, I guess.
Because he's just local on local stations and stuff. But now things are taking off.
There was a movie, a TV movie, that came out. I cannot remember the name of the movie, but his song "Time in a Bottle" was the theme song throughout the whole movie on TV, and that's when I knew that things were going to happen with Jimmy. And then his second album came out, And One Less Set of Footsteps was the lead song that they used for it. It went okay, got some airplay. Really didn't catch on, though. It's a good song. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But then they released Leroy Brown, and bada bing, bada boom, there it was. And I said, we're off and running now. And that sucker went number one. And this is why they brought him in to do the third album and the I Got a Name album, which was a song written by Fox and Gimble for a motion picture.
Well, now,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
He comes out, he's had these moderate hits and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you, by now you've heard him on the radio at some point. But now comes Leroy Brown.
Yeah.
Which, like, to this day, I still play.
Yeah.
Like, live, it's...
People love it.
Yeah, yeah, people love that song. It's just a timeless song.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? At this point, he can't get any high. He's...
Oh, I knew the plans he had. His plans were, because of his contact with Fox and Gimble and the motion picture, his plans were to move to California and start writing music primarily for motion pictures and TV shows. This is what he was interested in doing. So he buys a house in San Diego. And I saw him in August of 73. He had just bought the house in July, which is when Leroy Brown made number one. And Ingrid and AJ were at the house in California. He only spent like a day or two there, maybe three at the most, because then he was on the road traveling. And I saw him in Wildwood doing a concert there, and he hadn't spent much time at the house, but he was moving there to be closer to the movie scene, the TV scene, because that's what he was looking to do, to start to write more and more for that entertainment area. Oh, another interesting story, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
When they would be on TV, sometimes you see in these shows a Midnight Special, a few others that were on, you'd see Tommy playing piano along with Jimmy and Maury. Tommy would have to fly from New York to California, leave whatever he was doing in New York, to be with Jimmy to play the piano for the songs that they were doing on TV. And they had, I found this out from Tommy after Jimmy died, that they had seriously discussed calling me to go on tour with him. And Jimmy said, well, the last time I asked him to do a recording, he says, he's working full time, he's teaching and so forth, he can't leave that. And he said, I don't want to bother him. Which is fine, you know, I understood that. But I'm afraid that if he had called me, I might have said, yeah, let me pack, I'll be right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have died on the plane with him. So maybe it's a good thing that they didn't, you know, because I'm one of the many around who were proponents of his lifestyle, his music, his friendship, etc., passing it on and keeping the legacy in a sense alive, because some of us are dying off. Joe Saviolo died about 3 years ago. Tim Hauser died about a year and a half ago. So we're beginning to lose the people who knew Jimmy firsthand, personally. Yeah. So there's a few of us left, like his cousin, Steve Angelucci, who lives in Egg Harbor Township. He's, I think he's in his 60s now, you know. But eventually we're all going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the first line, so to speak, won't be around
anymore. Where were you that day?
I was in bed, asleep, and I had the radio to go off at, I think it was like 6:45 or something like that. Quarter to seven. And the radio came on, the news came on. And this was Friday morning. And they announced it. I sat straight up in bed. I didn't believe what I had heard. I thought I was having a nightmare or whatever. So I just stayed in bed. Because I knew another 15 minutes they were going to repeat it. They repeated it. I went ballistic. Started screaming. I ran into the kitchen because that's where the phone was on the wall. And I was saying to myself, oh God, does Richie know? Does Flora know, his mother? Because his dad had passed away just before he released his album, a couple months. And so I finally got it together, and I woke the kids up because I was just beside myself. I got a hold of Richie, he was in Florida. And evidently Tommy had called him a couple of hours earlier And I said, Richie, I'm so sorry. I said, does Flora know? Does your mom know? She says, no, but Uncle Sam's on the way over to be with her and going to break the news. I said, okay, good. Thank God for that. And I said, okay, I'll talk to you later. And then I went to work. And it was a tough day because I walked into work. I'm teaching at St. Thomas More High School at the time. And I'm just saying to people, my best friend died. Jim Croce's dead. No one knew I knew him. No one knew that Jim and I were friends. I never mentioned to anybody. I just kept it to myself because it was a very special thing.
Right.
But I wouldn't keep it myself anymore. I was telling people, and they just, and then when they heard the radio reports and so forth, they realized, and then things began to unravel, and they began, and I let them know, you know, how close Jim and I were. And yeah, that's a bad day. A real bad day.
And you're still feeling it after all these years. It's,
oh,
like you, yeah. You were very...
from time to time, like there were months I could not listen to his music. Even now, I listen to his music, and if I listen to too long and memories start to roll around, it just tears me up.
Are there certain songs that do it more than others?
Time in a Bottle. Because I was with Jimmy when the nucleus of that song was laid. When we'd run up to visit Ingrid when she was in Rhode Island in an art school, that night we got to see Bob Dylan along with the band. I told you about that. And on our way, and I think we were there like Friday night and Saturday night and came home Sunday. On the way home, he was really just very melancholy. He was so in love. He missed Ingrid already, right? So I said, Jim, what's wrong? You know, he said, Mike, wouldn't it be great if we could bottle time and any time just pop the cork and take a sip with the memories? I said, yeah, Jim, it'd be a great idea. A few years later, he writes that song. So I knew how significant that was. Now, when he wrote it, he wasn't only thinking of Ingrid, he was also thinking now of AJ, his son. Because this time, now things are starting to happen, and he couldn't be with his son as much as he wanted to be. It was like a double-edged sword. He's finally getting success, but it was tearing him away from his little boy. They did have some time together, but not as much as he would have liked. This is why he wanted to move to San Diego and so forth. So that song that tears me up. I know things about the different songs that he wrote that nobody else does, not even Ingrid. Because I was there when the nucleus was laid, and Ingrid wasn't. I'm not taking anything away from her. She knew a lot more about him personally because, you know, being married. But I was with him with a number of times when those little nuggets were just planted in his memory, and later on they come out in his songs. Like Leroy Brown. He's a real person. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people don't, but maybe the word has gotten out now. When Jimmy was in the National Guard, he met Leroy Brown. And Jimmy didn't particularly, he didn't like authority, all right? And one time I think he said that saying to his sergeant, the only way you became a sergeant was to have a frontal lobotomy. Sergeant didn't like that, put him on KP, I think, for a month. He might have even gone to Brig, I don't know. But anyway, he got to meet this guy, Leroy Brown, and swapping stories and so forth. And he tells a story about Leroy Brown. He says that he went AWOL. And the only way that they caught him was he came back for his paycheck after a month. And then that's what put him in the brig. But he was a real person, so Jimmy created a song about him. You don't mess around with Jim, about a pool player. We used to go to this pool hall in Upper Darby on Garrett Road. It was in the second story, the second floor of this shop or whatever. You had to go up this long stairway to get to it. You wouldn't know it's there unless you were looking for it. And we went there a couple of times and shoot pool and so forth. And the one time we go there, he hears guys talking or he saw something about it. I don't know how. But he found out that there was going to be a tournament. And guys were coming in from New York, Chicago, Detroit to participate in the pool tournament. And we're talking big money, right? So he said, Mike, why don't we come and watch this tournament? I said, what are you, nuts? You just don't walk into these things. I said, you're talking some serious stuff here, man. Nah, we'll be fine. We'll be great. We can get it. Yeah, no doubt. Jimmy was like that. Spur of the moment. I said, nope, not doing it. One of the few times I said, no, not doing it. Well, he went. He gets to the top of the stairs, and there's the bouncer. And the bouncer says, what do you want? He says, I'm here to watch the... He says, no, you're not. Jim started getting smart-mouthed with him, very, quick-witted or whatever. Guy picks him up, throws him down the steps, and Jim tells a story that he hit each step with his butt on the way down, and he calls it a character-building experience. So based on that and our experience in the pool hall, he wrote, you don't mess around with Jim. There was a judo instructor that he knew. He was about 5 foot nothing, but about this wide. And when he put his gi on, he looked like a refrigerator with a head. Well, that concept, refrigerator with a head, ended up in one of his songs, right?
Roller Derby Queen.
Roller Derby Queen, yeah. And a couple of others. You know, he just had a way of coming up with these lines. Oh, one of the people that he really admired was Chuck Berry. Loved Chuck Berry. Because of the way that Chuck Berry was able to paint pictures with words. And this is what Jimmy wanted to do. And one of the things that Jimmy did, a lot of people don't know also, Jimmy wrote haiku. You know what haiku is? It's a Japanese type of poetry where you have to express a full thought in, I think it's either 17 or 19 syllables. Very demanding. And he was good at it. So knowing haiku and being able to really get to the meat of the matter with words really helped him in his songwriting. I mean, where would you come up with, don't tug on Superman's cape, junkyard dog, those concepts, Just really original. There's so many others too. Just memories are flooding by.
What's your fondest memory of him? When someone says Jim Croce, or you just happen to turn on the radio and hear a song or anything. Pardon me. What's your fondest memory?
God, that's tough. I have so many. I guess it might be the last time I saw him. It was in August, 73. My wife and I went to the old convention hall in Wildwood. He was doing a small concert there. About 3,000-4,000 people. That's what he liked, actually. He didn't want to play big places. He liked the small venues. He liked it a little more personal. My wife had found out about the concert, and she said, why don't we go? And I was reluctant. I hadn't talked to Jimmy maybe in about a year or so. And I said, I hope he didn't go Hollywood, like what happens to a lot of performers. She said, no, come on, it'll be fine. Come on. He'd love to see you if you get back to see him. So we go there, and we got in early enough to where we're front row seats, right? So we see these doors on the side of the stage, and she says to me, go see if you can find him. Let him know you're here. And I still was reluctant. The opening act that he had was a rock band. I don't even remember their name. But they were known in the area, and they were getting ready to go on to perform. So I said, all right. I go to the door, open the door, and it's like a curved hallway that goes behind the stage, the way it was. And as I was walking down the hallway, this door is open, and there's a guy standing in the door. And I said, excuse me, I know this might sound, whatever. I said, but my name's Mike DiBenedetto. I'm a good friend of Jim Croce. Could you just tell him that I'm here? That's all I do. I hear, Mike, is that you? I turn my head and look in the door. It's Jimmy sitting next to Maury, and Maury's girlfriend was there. I said, hi, Jim. He said, hey, how you doing? He comes up, gives me a big hug, just like it was always. And we how you doing? Doing fine. What are you up to? Be out of here. He says, Mike, this is Maury Mulheiser. Maury, this is Mike. Maury says to me, you're Mike? He says, he does nothing but talk about you and all the things that you guys did together. He says, what a pleasure it is to meet you. Then he introduced me to his girlfriend. I think the other guy was maybe his road manager. I'm not sure. Well, we sat down. We started talking. Next thing, an hour and a half goes by. And what were we doing? We were swapping songs. Jim was singing songs from the third album, two of which hadn't been recorded yet, that they were getting ready to go into the studio. And I was singing some songs that I had written and other things, back and forth, just like always. And whose guitar was I using? Maury's. What an honor. He just, here, Mike, you use my guitar. Phenomenal. I guess that would be my fondest memory. The second fondest memory was when we were at school. At least once a day, Jim would say, hey, Mike, you got an extra cigarette? I'm trying to cut down. Sure. Now, we were smoking Winston's at the time, and I gave him a cigarette. And this would go on for a week or two. after about 2 weeks, next thing you know, he brings in a carton of cigarettes. He says, "Here, Mike." I said, "For crying out loud, if you're going to smoke, buy the carton for yourself." Why? He said, "I'm trying to cut down." I said, "All right, all right." There was even a time when he tried rolling his own. He went out and bought the tobacco in a bag and those papers and so forth, which most people use for doobies and so forth. And he's, you should see this. I wish we had a film of this. Him putting the tobacco in the paper, rolling it, licking it, and then he would twirl the ends, right? The tobacco wasn't that tight in there. He'd light a match or whatever, a lighter, take about two puffs, the damn thing would, you know, just explode in his face. He took two puffs and that was about it. Goodbye, cigarette. Well, that lasted about 2 or 3 weeks, but at least he tried, you know. So, yeah, I got a number of others.
Do you recall the last thing he said to you?
I don't know exactly the last thing, besides goodbye, you know, I had invited him to the house. I said, you know, if you're in the area, we're only about 40 miles away or whatever, in South Jersey, why don't you come over to the house, stay overnight, whatever, you and Maury, you know, you're more than welcome, bring anybody, you know, we'll make room for you, I'd love to have you. He says, I can't. He says, after tonight, he says, I got to get a plane and we're going to Minot, North Dakota. Who the hell ever heard of Minot, North Dakota? But that's where he was going for his next gig. I said, all right. I said, we'll catch each other I said, I'll see you probably around Christmas when you come to see, you know, Flora and the family. So he says, yeah, I'll see you at Christmas. Because we always got together at Christmas. Richie would come up from Florida. I would drive over from Jersey. Jimmy would come from Lindell. And we'd all gather at Flora's house in Drexel Hill. And she'd make a big dinner. And I remember one time we were there. My son was about a year and a half old. Jimmy didn't have AJ yet. And he said to me, boy, I don't know whether I could be a father or not. He turned out to be a pretty decent father, you know. But that was, yeah, there were some great memories at Flora's house. She treated me like a second son, or a third son, I guess you would say. Wonderful woman. I got to know his dad, too, pretty well. Great guy. But they just didn't like the idea of Jimmy going into the music business because of all the bad stories about it.
Right.
You know, they wanted him to do a 9-to-5 job or whatever, but it didn't work out. I'm glad it didn't, because we would have looked what we would have lost. You know, this wealth of music that's still being played today.
Mm-hmm.
There are young people in their teens who are discovering Jimmy. I guess it's by YouTube or other people talking or whatever. Because when I do shows, concerts or whatever, they're blown away by the types of songs that Jimmy did, and they just love him because he tells good stories. It's good music. I don't give a damn when it was done. It's good music, so it lasts forever. There's a movement on to get him into the induct him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's not rock and roll. You cannot categorize. What category are you going to put him into?
Right.
You can't.
Right. He was a singer-songwriter.
Yeah, that's it. He was a singer-songwriter, and he covered a myriad of genres.
Mm-hmm.
There are songs which are rock. There are songs which are folk. Like he did Maury's Salon and Saloon. That is, actually, if you look at the music from it, it's in 2/4, and it's classical based. It's a beautiful song, and Tommy plays piano on it, and Jimmy does the vocal for it. This is the type of stuff, it's like I said, all over the place. That's why the Facets album didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, now most of his songs are, most of Croce's songs are, you know, heavily acoustic.
Mm-hmm.
Was that for budget stuff, or did he just prefer acoustic as opposed to just get an electric guitar, a rock band?
We went back, when you go back to our early history, this is what we used. We used acoustic, so we got used to performing with acoustic guitars. It's also a lot easier if you're going to do a concert situation like Jimmy with Jimmy and Maury to just have acoustics. Have them mic'd or whatever. Go ahead.
Could it have been also out of necessity? I know they didn't make much money at all, if any, from the tours.
No, it wasn't out of necessity, though they didn't make much money from the tours, because the tours were put together before he actually became a star.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't make much money because they got him at a cut-rate price. Anyway, no, they used acoustics because that's what they liked. Now, on his third album, there's a guy named Henry Gross who plays electric guitar on a couple of the cuts. In fact, the one, 5 Short Minutes, dynamite guitar solo on it. Really nicely done. And Timmy and Tommy, Terry and Tommy, I'm sorry, produced an album of his, Henry Gross. And there was a hit from it. Great guitar player, great songwriter and singer. But I saw Tommy and I asked him about it. I said, I only got the one album. What happened? He said, well, the kid had a head problem. He just wouldn't listen and became infatuated with himself and we just couldn't do anything with him. I said, oh, all right. But he was on the album. I think he's on two different cuts on that third album. So when it was necessary or when it worked, Tommy would incorporate electric guitars. Mm. It was Tommy who determined, as producer, what instrumentation to use, whether strings, piano, or just acoustic, or acoustic plus piano and strings. You know. In fact, when Jimmy would listen to the final production, when Tommy got done, he was just blown away by the things that Tommy would do with these things, the string sections that he would bring in and other things, you know, horns.
I knew. Who did the piano for Leroy Brown? Was that Tommy?
Tommy.
That was Tommy West.
Yeah.
Because he said he layered it.
Yeah.
He overdubbed the two parts because it is a unique piano sound, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to have it just been that one track of just mm-hmm. the piano. Mm-hmm. For him to actually overdub it, and it's so distinct, but it tonality wise, it just has a unique sound.
Mm-hmm. And it really
and a fullness that
yeah,
only
exactly.
It's literally two pianos at the same
yeah.
time.
Yeah, it really adds, forms the basis for the song. It's mm-hmm. so perfect, you know. There's a song on the Croonin album by Anne Murray called Teach Me Tonight. It's a little bit slower than Leroy Brown, but I knew, as soon as I heard it, I said, oh, Tommy, you son of a gun, because it's got the Leroy Brown type of figure in it. Mm-hmm. But it works beautifully for the song. And Tommy's the one, like I said, who produced it and put everything together. And it's well done, you know.
Where do you see his legacy in 20 years?
Croce's?
Yeah. You see more people discovering him?
Oh, yeah. Because you have so many avenues now where people can hook into music. There's so many things on the internet that you can just stumble across. There's even a couple of Facebook pages and so forth which are dedicated to Jimmy. There's this one from Philadelphia, a guy's name called the Upper Darby Bill. And he's got a monstrous Croce page that you have to request to become a member of. And he's got thousands of people that are members of it. When I did my album, he asked if he could use some of the cuts from it for the Facebook. I said, sure. And I even, you know, gave him some, wrote some things for him to put on the Facebook page. Because they're trying to help my friend to be remembered and mm-hmm. To get his music out there so that people will be exposed to it. Yeah. I don't think it's going to change, because even today, music from years and years ago is still being played, and people are still appreciating it, and even young people are beginning to latch onto it, and they're using that, like other people do, to form a basis maybe for music that they're going to perform or to right. write, you know. So it's standard,
yeah.
so to speak.
No, there's things I use. Croce was a big influence to my early writing, and you know, him, Chapin.
Oh yeah, Gordon Lightfoot.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But Croce was very much a big staple of that. I just really liked his music. I liked the way he was different.
Yeah.
He just had this coolness about him. Just the blue jeans, the jacket, the... Yeah.
No, that was for convenience purposes.
Yeah.
yeah. Because the traveling and so forth, it made it tough for them to...
I know him and Murray used to change shirts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, they'd do one show, and the next show they would just wear each other's shirts, so they at least had something different to wear.
Yeah.
Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
You have anything to... add to that, any little anecdote or any little story or anything.
You just mentioned. Go ahead.
No,
just say what you're going to say.
I have no idea what I was going to say.
Gosh, let me think. Something had occurred to me. Now I forgot what it was. If it's important, I'll give you a call and let you know. But I appreciate what you're doing, man. At the, you know, and I'm looking forward to listening to this. So I hope I did a good job for
you. Oh, you did great.
You know,
you did great.
Yeah. It was a pleasure sharing all this stuff with you, so, you know, to bolster your knowledge even more about Jimmy and some things that maybe most people, you know, the common people wouldn't know, only those of us who were around him. You might notice also, I don't call him Jim.
No.
I called him Jimmy. We knew each other as that, Jimmy, and he would call me Mike. That was it. And when I saw Jim Croce, I said, what? Okay. In fact, when he and Ingrid put the first album out, to see how they have Croce at the top of it?
Yeah.
They were going to spell it phonetically. C-R-O-C-H-E-E. So it looked like almost Indian, like a Native American name, Croce. But they left it alone. She was, she's got a book out, I don't know whether you know it or not, called I Got a Name.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw her about a year and a half ago when she was doing a book tour. And, she was so nice. She really was. In fact, we're in this Barnes & Noble place, and we had gotten a book, and I just wanted her to autograph it for me and my wife. So she sees me standing over to the side while her and her husband are talking about Jimmy, or her primarily. And she sees me and she says, there's Mike DiBenedetto, one of Jim's closest friends. Mike, come over here. Come and tell the people about Jimmy. So I spoke for maybe 10 minutes, and I said, here. And I tried to give her the microphone back. She says, no, talk some more. Tell them about Jimmy. So I did. I thought it was really nice of her. I thought, because I was taken away from her time. But she was just, we've known each other ever since the very beginning when Jim and her first met. And like I said, we spent a lot of time at her house singing and playing. And the visiting in Rhode Island and so forth. Oh, I wanted to show you something before I go.
Sure.
See this here?
Yeah, it's a belt buckle.
Yeah, but it's made of nickel. It's pure nickel.
Uh-huh.
Jimmy got it when he was in Mexico visiting Ingrid, and he brought it back as a present for me. He says, here, Mike, something to remember Mexico by. He was like that. He would think of you. Yeah. I think I've talked enough.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you have any questions or comments, hit me up at Dan Morrow Music. That's DanMarrow Music at gmail.com. Also, find me on social media at Dan Morrow Music or #Dan Morrow Music. I'm Dan Morrow. Have a great day. See you next time.